Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bolling, Executive Director. I'm pleased to bring you a series of sessions from the DPharm 2017 conference, which covers new ways of thinking about how we can advance innovation in clinical trials. The 2018 DPharm conference takes place September 25th and 26th in Boston. In this first podcast, Dr. Zach Kohani, Chair of the Department of Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, talks about how to align incentives to share clinical data. He reports on the outcome of the Sprint Challenge, which is like the poster child of data sharing in today's environment. Enjoy the session.
So thank you. I'm very amused by the Harvard versus MIT attention. It's a good one. And I have to say that since I got trained in both places and that, actually, I do have a PhD in computer science, you should know there's actually a joint division across Harvard and MIT called the Division of Health Sciences Technology, where we actually work together often. But I'm here to give you a very, very concrete and telling history of a data sharing effort that arose out of a hashtag research parasite. So 2 years ago, the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Jeff Drazen, wrote an editorial saying we have to recognize that there's a misalignment of incentives between the trialists and the data analysts that some, he did not coin the term, that some call research parasites. But then what happened is a lot of people like myself, data scientists, took umbrage to the research parasite description, and it went truly viral. And even, so there was hashtag, I am a research parasite, and the editor of Science, then Marsha McNutt, wrote articles about it. And so I met with Dr. Drazen, and I said, what can we do to actually talk about aligning these incentives? And to do so, we decided to see how far we could go. So I'm going to quickly describe to you a trial, the Sprint trial, which was a blood pressure reduction trial that we made the data available early. We made a contest, and then we had a meeting where patients, trialists, research parasites, all were together, and we had a very honest and very revealing discussion afterwards. So let me quickly run you through the trial. So it's called the Sprint trial, and basically it asks the question, instead of getting your systolic blood pressure under 140, can we do better if we get it under 120? And this trial was very successful in the sense that they were really able in the intensive care group to get blood pressure down, as you can see. And in terms of the number of cardiovascular events, it seemed that there was a reduction in the number of cardiovascular events by reducing systolic blood pressure to 120. And as a result, this trial was stopped before it was planned to end because there was such an impressive change. And the ethical board said, you cannot continue further. Which, by the way, from disruptive farm perspective, it's interesting that there was no drugs here, but here we have a study effect that many drug companies would love to be able to claim, but it was just different ways of managing those medications. And so, as a result, there was a publication of these results in the New England Journal of Medicine in November 2015, and because of the increased concern of not sharing data in a timely fashion because of the research parasite issue, we decided to have this contest. And we made this challenge, and we broadcast the challenge internationally. And this was a difficult challenge, because what we said to the contestants, you're going to have to take this data and show us something interesting that we did not already know with this data. And in order to get access to this data, you're going to have to go through an IRB, institutional review board procedure, and you're also going to have to answer some questions about the original study, so we know that you know how to read a clinical trial paper, which is not obvious. And I can tell you it was challenging. And so what you see here is the attrition from 279 applicants, international applicants, all the way to 143 applicants that 143 teams applied with full-on innovative interpretations of this data set. By the way, I won a case of wine from Jeff Drazen because he thought this was going to be hokey, and he thought that less than 30 teams internationally would apply, but we, in fact, had these 143 teams that went the distance. First point I want to make is that the people at the SPRINT trial who were NHLBI and National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, which is one of the NIH institutes, and NHLBI-funded investigators, were gracious in making the data available early, but they were a little bit grumpy. And why were they grumpy? And it's important to understand, because A, the data was in a somewhat scattered form, and putting it all together so that the contestants could see it, understand it in relatively short order was work. One. Two, there was a clear sense that they were going to be scooped. There was a first paper that they had just put out, but there's many other papers that they were going to write. And now they were going to make all their data available, and any investigator throughout the world could come up with an interesting finding. The third concern was a concern that I've heard widely shared among trialists. They don't talk about it out loud, but it's just a natural human concern, is like in every other human endeavor, there's a worry that you made a mistake. You do your best to avoid mistakes, but nothing as big as a huge trial with thousands of individuals is going to occur flawlessly. And by making the data available, you're allowing a sort of gotcha phenomenon to happen where people can find what was wrong in your trial. And so I have to say, it was very gracious on their part. I'm going to now jump back and forth between the contest and the conference that happened at the end. The conference that happened at the end was really interesting because not only were there patient advocates and the trialists and the data scientists, but there were at the table in the room, about this big, the funders, the modern funders of research, of clinical research, including pharma companies, but also the Wellcome Trust, the Gates Foundation, and the NIH. So this was a tricky discussion to have because these were the funders in the room. And so I can tell you that what was very clear was, on the one hand, the trialists had their concerns. On the other side, the funders were fairly unanimous that the old way of doing things, namely making sure that the data was right, making sure people would reinterpret it, that way was not going to be funded for much longer. That's at least what they said. And there were several very obvious tensions. Going into the meeting, the trialists wanted to make a point that going just from the old way of doing trials to the modern way, the current way, which is clinicaltrials.gov, which is where we register all our trials, that, they claimed, cost millions of dollars, and that's much less effort than sharing a trial. All you're doing is sharing, declaring what the criteria are for the trial and what are the primary and secondary endpoints. Sharing the data, they said, would be an order of magnitude more money, and therefore, this would not be millions of dollars, but hundreds of millions of dollars that would be required for data sharing. I'm just saying what were the concerns expressed. At the same time, what was very interesting is The trialists, I think wisely, introduced the patients who had participated in the sprint trial. And these patients ran the gamut of socio-educational spectrum, from blue-collar workers to venture capitalists. And what was very interesting is at the beginning of the conference, they absolutely said how excited they were to be in the part of this trial, how important they viewed being part of the trial, and how grateful they were for having been part of the trial. By the end of the conference, the patients were still grateful, but they shared that they were actually somewhere between surprised to shocked and disturbed about the fact that their data was not being shared. They had assumed, by and large, that their data was being shared quite broadly, and they were completely unaware of the issues about professional alignment. At the same time, there was a lot of clarity that investigators will spend years of their lives putting together all the details that it takes to put together a large trial, and having one publication may not be a good career gambit, as opposed to if you make the data available and you're a data analyst, you can publish several papers a year because you're not investing that time early on. And so I'm glad if I give myself a few minutes at the end to answer your question, to discuss potential workarounds, but it was still left as an open question. How do you basically bridge this essential problem between the generators of data and their investment and their career objectives and the trialists and the public interests? How did this contest show us new things or interesting things? First of all, I have to say, several of the contestants found a few errors in the original data set, including, for example, the use of the Framingham Heart Score to predict expected number of cardiovascular events. Now, fortunately for the contest and for the original authors, the error in the calculation of cardiovascular risk score did not affect their trial results materially. But it was an error, and there was a second error that was found that also did not find an error materially. But at the same time, it made it very obvious, at least to me, that having more eyeballs on the data early on is valuable. But I am absolutely sympathetic with the notion that when you're responsible for putting the data out there and running the trial, it's very uncomfortable to make all your warts visible, because in fact, every trial has its issues. At the same time, it was also very clear to me that the contestants did not disagree with the overall outcomes in the study, but they did come up with many other conclusions that were not obvious in this study, and they ranged all the way from interesting observations that certainly require further investigation. For example, there seemed to be, I believe it was the magnesium levels in some of these patients seemed to be very correlated with some of these cardiovascular outcomes. And if that was indeed the case, it would require another trial, that would tell us that we should be focusing a little bit more on magnesium levels. But what was very interesting is a lot of the contestants noticed that not everybody in the intensive arm benefited, and not everybody in the less intensive arm had these bad cardiovascular events. Could you actually come up with predictive models that would allow you to figure out these subgroups and, based on the actual data, give customized advice? And several groups did. And for example, this the second prize went to a group at BU, which actually, and it was amazing, they came together and came up with a calculator of risk based on the damage to the kidney, which definitely happened in a subgroup. And they came up with a very nice calculator. And there was a, let me skip past this, and there was a group in Israel which received the first prize. And the person who did the analysis could not come to receive her award because he was just delivering her children. But they run around this healthcare center, Clalit, and they came up with an app that allows you to individualize your therapy based on the sprint trial data, and they validated those results against the Clalit, their healthcare system data. And I'll just quickly show you what their app looked like. And it shows with the green and red bars the additional risk and benefit that you, individual patient, could expect. And it was a good, nice joint decision-making procedure for the doctors and the patients to go through. Something that, if you didn't have access to the data, would not be available. I want to make some other quick points in closing, and I'll give myself 3 minutes at the end for questions. There was also a point made that there are, in fact, several shared databases that are available to the public of pharma trials. And here's the sad fact. It's not that, in this case, the pharma did not want to share the data. It's that no one then goes and looks at the data. Even in NHLBI data that I just described, because of our contest, the sprint trial became the third most accessed trial in NHLBI history. Number one, of course, is Framingham. But just in the short history of this one paper and across the long history of the NHLBI data, this trial all of a sudden is the third ranked in terms of public use of the data. So what it tells me is that although there are legitimate, real concerns about making data available, the truth is, whether it's because of lack of awareness or lack of interest or lack of capabilities, the fact is, even when these data are made available, they are grossly underused. And I mean just handfuls at best of investigators. So I think I want to stop there and take questions from the audience in my remaining 2.5 minutes. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Cindy Gagan, and I'm a patient advocate, and I was involved in one of those other data sharing initiatives, Project DataSphere, which was a database of clinical trials in cancer, oncology clinical trials. So I want to underscore two things. One is patients are mortified that their data is not being shared. Two, it's a voluntary effort. So pharma put their trials in there, they have to de-identify it. It's very resource intensive. And then when it's not being utilized without a competition or some sort of incentive. So Project DataSphere ran some competitions with Sage BioNetworks in their Dream Challenges in prostate cancer and found some new prognostic tools, et cetera. But how, without resources, how do you incentivize the use and application of these data?
I'm sorry, because the microphone's a little blurry. How what?
How can you incentivize people to use the data and with things like challenges in this?
To use the data? How do you identify the people?
Well, how do you incentivize them?
How do you,
what are the incentives for people to use the data once it's put out there and shared?
Well, I think that's the right question. So for a long time, I thought this stupid pet trick of giving competitions and prizes was going to fade out years ago. But apparently, that works. And so the fact is, analytic talent is far and few in between. And so I think either creating publicly funded analyses or these kind of contests are, for me, the only way I can imagine doing it. And so, for example, one of my former students, Atul Butte, is working with NIAID on the import trials, and he's still having to bang the drum very, very loud to get the import trials looked at. So I think there's still a fair amount of advocacy, but that only goes so far, but showmanship in paying a different group of investigators to look at the data, and this amazingly simple trick of running a contest.
Hi, Zach. Bray Patrick Lake. So I had the good pleasure of actually sitting next to, I call them kids, from the Sprint Challenge. And so we were at dinner with Jeff Drazen from New England Journal, and it was these worlds coming together. So we have this, you know, established research, peer review world that these kids literally knew nothing about. I had to turn and say, hey, that's, by the way, that's the editor of New England Journal. They had a lot of fun in their dorm room playing with data, and they did something really cool. So can you speak to kind of the tensions that we face between people that have, they've dedicated their entire professional career to academia, but yet we've got this entire generation of new brains and excited people that know data. If you saw, you know, Dana Lewis, I'm sure you know her being here yesterday, who just did some things that are really cool. How do we invite these new minds in, but yet we have this rigorous construct around being promoted and getting tenure that kind of stifles innovation at times?
Well, it's easier for me to answer the second part of the question, and you're absolutely right. It was, I think everybody felt inspired by these young people because for them, medicine was great. They did not see or were not intimidated by all the things that we are intimidated by, the structural problems in medicine. They said, we're gonna go out and solve it. And so I think, to your point, and I think you posed the question extremely well, is how do we make them aware of it and how do we incent them? They don't need a lot of incentives. What we need is to actually just rejigger a bit our educational system. Because I could imagine how just making part of the medical school curriculum or college curriculum or even high school curriculum, these kinds of analyses, it's not for everybody, but I'm very confident because I've seen it happening. By the way, I just saw a deep learning in the BioArchive preprint server. I just saw an amazing article on identifiability and creating of faces written by high school students in Palo Alto. Now, they're not the standard students, but I think at all points, if the educational system took this seriously, the students would do it, and it would be more fun for them than many of the exercises we actually ask them to do. And here's my quick advertisement. Harvard Medical School has changed its curriculum. There's something called Pathways. First year is didactic, second year is clinical instead of the third year. And third year, there's a bunch of courses, including computational medicine that I'm teaching. And we actually had more students applying to it than for genetics or immunology. And a central part of this course for medical students, astonishingly, is looking at these data sets and analyzing them. So I think that the answer to your second question, the second part of your question, is I think we have to, as part of our teaching, that has to be an ongoing part. For the first part, for the trialists, I actually think that the best way to deal with it is to make the promotion committees understand the difference between a trial paper, which is a huge contribution. Randomized controlled trials are a huge contribution. And as much as I love Nature Cell Science papers, some of them can be done a lot faster than in the 10-year interval. So I think sorting that out, which is not an easy thing to do, would probably be the best way, because I think it comes down to issues of professional recognition, which seems tiny. But I think when you talk to the individuals, it's those individual motivations that end up gumming the works or not. Did I answer your question,
Greg? Yeah, perfectly. Thank you.
All right. And if there are no other questions, thank you very much.
Mark your calendars for the 8th Annual DFARM Conference, which takes place September 25th, 26th, 2018 in Boston. For more information on DFARM and DFARM podcasts, visit theconferenceforum.org. Thank you.